2. Bill Denbrough gets a look. Perhaps it was simply the dimness of the room that caused the illusion, which lasted for only the briefest moment. But Bill wondered later if it wasn't some sort of message meant strictly for him, that fate could also be kind. In that brief moment, it seemed to him that none of them had grown up, that his friends had somehow done a Peter Pan act and were all still children. Richie Tozier was rocked back in his chair so that he was leaning against the wall, caught in the act of saying something to Beverly Marsh, who had a hand cupped over her mouth to hide a giggle. Richie had a wise-ass grin on his face that was perfectly familiar. And there was Eddie Kasprak, sitting on Beverly's left, and in front of him on the table, next to his water glass, was a plastic squeeze bottle with a pistol grip handle curving down from its top. The trimmings were a little more state-of-the-art, but the purpose was obviously the same. It was an aspirator. Sitting at one end of the table, watching this trio with an expression of mixed anxiety, amusement, and concentration, was Ben Hanscom. Bill found his hand wanting to go to his head and realized with a sorry kind of amusement that in that second he had almost rubbed his pate to see if his hair had magically come back, that red, fine hair that he had begun to lose when he was only a college sophomore. That broke the bubble. Richie was not wearing glasses, he saw, and thought, he probably has contacts now. He would. He hated those glasses. The T-shirts and cord pants he'd habitually worn had been replaced by a suit that hadn't been purchased off any rack. Bill estimated that he was looking at $900 worth of tailor-made on the hoof. Beverly Marsh, if her name still was Marsh, had become a stunningly beautiful woman. Instead of the casual ponytail, her hair, which was almost exactly the same shade his own had been, spilled over the shoulders of her plain white Chippenshaw blouse in a torrent of subdued color. In this dim light, it merely glowed like a well-banked bed of embers. In daylight, even the light of such a subdued day as this one, Bill imagined it would flame. And he found himself wondering what it would feel like to plunge his hands into that hair. The world's oldest story, he thought wryly. I love my wife, but oh, you kid. Eddie, it was weird but true, had grown up to look quite a little bit like Anthony Perkins. His face was prematurely lined, although in his movements he seemed somehow younger than either Richie or Ben, and made older still by the rimless spectacles he wore, spectacles you would imagine a British barrister wearing as he approached the bench or leafed through a legal brief. His hair was short, worn in an out-of-date style that had been known as Ivy League in the late 50s and early 60s. He was wearing a loud, checked sport coat that looked like something grabbed from the distress sale rack of a men's clothing store that would shortly be out of business. But the watch on one wrist was a Patek Philippe, and the ring on the little finger of his right hand was a ruby. The stone was too hugely vulgar and too ostentatious to be anything but real. Ben was the one who had really changed, and, looking at him again, Bill felt unreality wash easily over him. His face was the same, and his hair, although graying and longer, was combed in the same unusual right side part. But Ben had gotten thin. He sat easily enough in his chair, his unadorned leather vest open to show the blue chambray work shirt beneath. He wore Levi's with straight legs, cowboy boots, and a wide belt with a beaten silver buckle. These clothes clung easily to a body which was slim and narrow-hipped. He wore a bracelet with heavy links on one wrist, not gold links, but copper ones. He got thin, Bill thought. He's a shadow of his former self, so to speak. Old Ben got thin. Wonders never cease. There was a moment of silence among the six of them that was beyond description. It was one of the strangest moments Bill Denbrough ever passed in his life. Stan was not here, but a seventh had come nonetheless. Here in this private restaurant dining room, Bill felt its presence so fully that it was almost personified, but not as an old man in a white robe with a scythe on his shoulder. It was the white spot on the map which lay between 1958 and 1985, an area an explorer might have called the Great Don't Know. Bill wondered what exactly was there. Beverly Marsh in a short skirt which showed most of her long, coltish legs, a Beverly Marsh in white go-go boots, her hair parted in the middle and ironed. Richie Tozier carrying a sign which said, Stop the War on one side and Get ROTC off campus on the other. Ben Hanscom in a yellow hard hat with a flag decal on the front, running a bulldozer under a canvas parasol, his shirt off, showing a stomach which protruded less and less over the waistband of his pants? Was this seventh creature black? No relation to either H-Rap Brown or Grandmaster Flash, not this fellow. This fellow wore plain white shirts and fade into the woodwork J.C. Penney slacks, and he sat in a library carrel at the University of Maine writing papers on the origin of footnotes and the possible advantages of ISBN numbers in book cataloging, while the marchers marched outside and Phil Oak sang Richard Nixon, Find Yourself Another Country to Be Part Of, and men died with their stomachs blown out for villages whose names they could not pronounce. He sat there studiously bent over his work. Bill saw him, which lay in a slant of crisp white winter light, his face sober and absorbed, knowing that to be a librarian was to come as close as any human being can to sitting in the peak seat of eternity's engine. Was he the seventh? Or was it a young man, standing before his mirror, looking at the way his forehead was growing, looking at a comb full of pulled-out red hairs, looking at a pile of university notebooks on the desk reflected in the mirror, notebooks which held the completed, messy first draft of a novel entitled Joanna, which would be published a year later? Some of the above, all of the above, none of the above. It didn't matter, really. The seventh was there, and in that one moment they all felt it, and perhaps understood best the dreadful power of the thing that had brought them back. It lives, Bill thought, cold inside his clothes. Eye of Newt, Tail of Dragon, Hand of Glory. Whatever it was, it's here again in Derry. It. And he felt suddenly that it was the seventh, that it and time were somehow interchangeable, that it wore all their faces as well as the thousand others with which it had terrified and killed. And the idea that it might be them was somehow the most frightening idea of all. How much of us was left behind here, he thought with sudden rising terror. How much of us never left the drains and the sewers where it lived and where it fed? Is that why we forgot? Because part of each of us never had any future, never grew, never left Derry. Is that why? He saw no answers on their faces, only his own questions reflected back at him. Thoughts form and pass in a matter of seconds or milliseconds and create their own time frames, and all of this passed through Bill Denbrough's mind in the space of no more than 5 seconds. Then Richie Tozier, leaning back against the wall, grinned again and said, "Oh my, look at this. Bill Denbrough went for the chrome dome look. How long you been turtle waxing your head, Big Bill?" And Bill, with no idea at all of what might come out, opened his mouth and heard himself say, "Fuck you and the horse you rode in on, trash mouth." There was a moment of silence, and then the room exploded with laughter. Bill crossed to them and began to shake hands, and while there was something horrible in what he now felt, there was also something comforting about it, this sensation of having come home for good.